That's okay with people, yeah. So, I mean, as I said, this part of the chapter, this is about chapter five of the Revolution Betrayed, which is titled The Soviet Thermidor, and it's part two, which is on the degeneration of the Bolshevik Party. And this part of the chapter is quite simple, but it's crucial, and it centers on basic questions about the nature and functioning of a revolutionary party, and how in those circumstances they were turned into their opposite. So Trotsky talks at length about about this transformation, about its point of departure, and about the causes of the change. And he writes quite clearly in this section. He writes that the quote, the inner regime of the Bolshevik Party was characterized by the method of democratic centralism. The combination of these two concepts, democracy and centralism, is not in the least contradictory. The party took watchful care not only that its boundaries should always be strictly defined, but also that all who entered these boundaries should enjoy the actual right to define the direction of the party policy. Freedom of criticism and intellectual struggle was an irrevocable content of the party democracy. The present doctrine that Bolshevism does not tolerate factions is a myth of the epoch of decline. In reality, the history of Bolshevism is a history of the struggle of factions. And indeed, how could a genuinely revolutionary organization, setting itself the task of overthrowing the world and uniting under its banner the most audacious iconoclasts, fighters, and insurgents, live and develop without intellectual conflicts, without groupings and temporary factional formations? The far-sightedness of the Bolshevik leadership often made it possible to soften conflicts and shorten the duration of factional struggle, but no more than that. The Central Committee relied upon this seething democratic support. From this, it derived the authority to make decisions and give orders. The obvious correctness of the leadership at all critical stages gave it that high authority, which is the priceless moral capital of centralism. Now, I mean, this whole concept and this whole ethos is completely at odds with the practice that developed later in the USSR in the aftermath of the Thermidor, whose nature we'll actually expand upon later in this discussion, in the ongoing discussion, that is. But Trotsky wrote about the contrasting regime of the Bolsheviks later. He wrote this. He says that the regime of the Bolshevik Party, especially before it came to power, thus stood in complete contradiction to the regime of the present sections of the Communist International, with their leaders appointed from above, making complete changes of policy at a word of command, with their uncontrolled apparatus, haughty in its attitude to the rank and file, servile in its attitude to the Kremlin. But in the first years after the conquest of power, also, even when the administrative rust was already visible on the party, every Bolshevik, not excluding Stalin, would have denounced as a malicious slanderer anyone who should have shown him on a screen the image of the party 10 or 15 years earlier. Now, however, as we'd already discussed, this was not a conscious process, at least not initially. It was actually the product of changed circumstances, of privations and difficulties arising from the isolation of the revolution. And in particular, it was initially the product of the situation that all the softer left parties that had supported the coming to power of the proletariat in October 1917, or at least the pledged to work constructively as an opposition to the Bolsheviks within the Soviet framework, they all betrayed these fine words. And the imperialists declared war on the Bolsheviks, and they sought to fund anybody who could be bribed or persuaded of what in reality was the virtue of being bribed to join in the crusade against the Soviet regime. And as the Civil War got underway, that became a crucial phenomena. And Trotsky explained, he says, he said, He said, democracy has been narrowed in proportion of the as the difficulties increased. In the beginning, the party had wished and hoped to preserve freedom of political struggle within the framework of the Soviets. The Civil War introduced stern amendments to this calculation. The opposition parties were forbidden one after the other. This measure, obviously in conflict with the spirit of Soviet democracy, the leaders of Bolshevism regarded not as a principle, but as an episodic act of self-defense. But they really had no choice but to do this, because it was a product of the disparity between the material resources that the revolution had at its disposal versus those of its enemies, its imperialist enemies. And obviously, Soviet Russia was created out of the most backward of the imperialist powers, and the resources of its enemies were so much, much greater, enormously greater. And in some ways, that's not very different from the phenomenon we see today. Where the imperialists promote these color revolutions and things around the world with their money power, basically, But the Bolsheviks' resources the resources that they had to combat it were much more limited than even many of the opponents of these color revolutions are today, But there is a problem that follows logically from the suppression of opposition parties in a state dominated by a large, authoritative and democratic party with a mass base among large sections of the population. And it's not so much a process of infiltration. The Bolsheviks were always vigilant against that until the policy was changed by the Troika. But it's about social pressure, which the mass base of the party are vulnerable to, which in turn can only find reflection in the party itself. Abolishing other parties that represent other social forces doesn't abolish those social forces. What happens instead is that they, instead of expressing their political will through their own parties, they start to exert social pressure on the Revolutionary Party itself. And that's what the Bolshevik leaders came to fear. And as a result, even Lenin and Trotsky felt obliged to take the logical measure that flowed from that. So Trotsky wrote that the swift growth of the ruling party, with the novelty and immensity of its tasks, inevitably gave rise to inner disagreements. The underground oppositional currents in the country exerted a pressure through various channels upon the sole legal political organization, increasing the acuteness of the factional struggle. At the moment of completion of the Civil War, this struggle took such sharp forms as to threaten to unsettle the state power. In March 1921, in the days of the Kronstadt Revolt, which attracted into its ranks no small number of Bolsheviks, the 10th Congress of the party thought it necessary to resort to a prohibition of factions, that is, to transfer the political regime prevailing in the state to the inner life of the ruling party. This forbidding of factions was again regarded as an exceptional measure to be abandoned at the first serious improvement in the situation. And at the same time, the Central Committee was extremely cautious in applying the new law, concerning itself most of all lest it lead to a strangling of the inner life of the party. Now, that was meant to be temporary, but the problem is that the contradictions that gave rise to it militated against that. You can argue that it ought to have been rejected, but that was unlikely for reasons of self-preservation. The motive, there was no sinister motive for it, nothing totalitarian or anything like that. Just the conviction and fear that if the party did not hang together, they would hang separately, according to the old saying. The problem is, though, that it fitted perfectly the agenda of the emerging bureaucracy. As Trotsky said, it began to approach the inner life of the party exclusively from the viewpoint of convenience in administration. As he noted about Stalin, he wrote, the entire effort of Stalin, with whom at the time Zinoviev and Kamenev were working hand in hand, that is the Troika, by the way, was thenceforth directed to freeing the party machine from the control of the rank and file members of the party. In this struggle for stability of the Central Committee, Stalin proved the most consistent and reliable among his colleagues. He had no need to tear himself away from international problems. He'd never been concerned with them. The petty bourgeois outlook of the new ruling strata was his own outlook. He profoundly believed that the task of creating socialism was national and administrative in its nature. He looked upon the Communist International as a necessary evil would be, which should be used as far as possible for the purposes of po foreign policy. His own party kept a value in his eyes merely as administrative support for the machine. And for this convenience, so-called, immediately after the death of Lenin, Stalin completely did away with, actually, talking of infiltration, Stalin did completely away with the safeguards of the party against being infiltrated by elements with a different class outlook, by international, sorry, by backward elements. And that infiltration, you could call it that, was called the Leninist Levy. And it basically involved the admission of many, many new members to the party. So, as Trotsky wrote, he says, workers, clerks, petty officials flocked through in crowds. The political aim of this maneuver was to dissolve the revolutionary vanguard in new raw human material, without experience, without independence, and yet with the old habit of submitting to the authorities. The scheme was successful. By freeing the bureaucracy from the control of the proletarian vanguard, the so-called Leninist levy dealt a death blow to the party of Lenin. The machine had won the necessary independence. Democratic centralism gave place to bureaucratic centralism. In the party apparatus itself, there now took place a radical reshuffling of personnel from top to bottom. The chief merit of a Bolshevik was declared to be obedience. But this gave the appearance to the population, to the mass of the population, to be a remote factional struggle over successions. As Trotsky said, he said, the political meaning of the developing struggle was darkened for many by the circumstances that the leaders of all three groupings, left, centre, and right, belonged to one and the same staff in the Kremlin, to the Politburo. To superficial minds, it seemed to be a mere matter of personal rivalry, a struggle for the heritage of Lenin. But in conditions of iron dictatorship, social antagonisms could not show themselves at first, except through the institutions of the ruling party. And that led to a certain result, of course. It led to, as Trotsky said, it led to this. It says, of the Politburo of Lenin's epoch, there now remains only Stalin. Two of its members, Zinoviev and Kamenev, collaborators of Lenin through many years of émigrés, are enduring 10-year prison cell terms for a crime which they did not commit. Three other members, Rykov, Bukharin, and Tomsky, are completely removed from the leadership, but as a reward for submission, occupy secondary posts. And finally, referring to himself, he says, the author of these lines is in exile. The widow of Lenin, Krupskaya, is also under the ban, having proved unable with all her efforts to adjust completely to the Thermidor. So, I mean, that basically sketches out the basic facts about the degeneration of the party, how it began, what fueled it, and how it concluded. Now, in the final few paragraphs of this part, Trotsky sketches out a few relevant facts that go deeper into the reasons for the political degeneration of the apparatus and the social basis of it. Such things always have something in common. The conquest of the conquerors by the conquered, when the conquered are on a higher cultural level. So Trotsky wrote again, says, at the 11th Congress of the party in March 1922, Lenin gave warning of the danger of a degeneration of the ruling stratum. It has occurred more than once in history, he said, that the conqueror took over the culture of the conquered when the latter stood on a higher level. The culture of the Russian bourgeoisie and the old bureaucracy was, to be sure, miserable, but alas, the new ruling stratum must often take its hat off to that culture. 4,700 responsible communists in Moscow administer the state machine, said Lenin. Who is leading who? I doubt very much whether you can say that the communists are in the lead. In subsequent congresses, Lenin could not speak. And the remarks from Christian Rakovsky about the historical remarks he made about the intermarriage of the Jacobins with the young ladies of the aristocracy after 1789 and the role that played in the original Thermidor also cast light on the Soviet Thermidor as well, what they called the automobile harem factor. That is someone who got a car and what he saw as a nice wife is, of course, relevant, as well as, of course, is the rise not only of secondary and very much junior figures in the period of the revolution to the front rank of the party, but also elements who were enemies of the revolution at the time, enemies of the 1917 revolution. And there are several of those, of course, which we will go into later, most likely. This also indicates the political and social degeneration of the political life of the party. And Trotsky reproduces this anecdote from the critical writings of a guy called Sosnovsky about a particular article in Pravda. And he writes that the director of a Moscow factory, a prominent communist, boasts in Pravda of the cultural growth of the enterprise directed by him. A mechanic telephones, "What is your order, sir? Check the furnace immediately or wait?" And he replies, "I answer, wait." And the mechanic addresses, it's in Russian, of course, the mechanic addresses the director with extreme respect, using the second person plural, whereas the director answers him in the second person singular. And this disgraceful dialogue, impossible in any cultured capitalist country, is related by the director himself in the pa in, on the pages of Pravda as something entirely normal. The editor does not object because he does not notice it. The readers do not object because they are accustomed to it. How can they fail to remember that one of the most popular revolutionary slogans in Tsarist Russia was the demand for the abolition of the use of the second person singular by bosses in addressing their subordinates? And the thing is, that doesn't really work in English because that construct doesn't exist anymore in English, if it ever did. But it will certainly be understood very well by French speakers because the same thing actually exists. You know, I suppose its equivalent in English is a boss expecting the worker to tug his forelock in deference to to him or something. You know, it's a linguistic form in other languages, you know. But it's a sign reproduced in the Soviet press without even being noticed, as Trotsky says, of just how social relations in the USSR had degenerated in the decade and a half after the revolution. It was a striking symbol of the Thermidor. And I will leave it there. I think that's the end of my sort of talk on this aspect of on this piece of the work anyway. And we'll open it up to discussion. And welcome to Susan.
Hello, Susan. Hi.
While I was talking.
Hi. Sorry about that.
Hello, Susan.
I forgot you were going to come early at 3 o'clock instead of four.
No problem.
The one thing I would say, though, is that the British knew all about the hat. It was not just the tugging the forelock, but it was also the removal of the hat. Who wore a hat? Who took off their hat?
Right.
And a whole load of niceties about we lost our sumptuary laws, what colour you could wear, and what grade of clothing you could wear. Sort of after the Middle Ages, but the feudal system still remained in the various niceties of clothing, didn't they?
Yeah,
It's interesting that
Maria.
at the time, can I come in, Susan, or have you finished?
Please do, yeah.
Yeah, you
At
speak.
the time of the Tsar, in the document, he mentions when at the time of the Tsar, the elimination of this, is it thou or tu? It's tu in French.
It's two and view in French, and it's T and V in Russian, or something like that.
Right. And the elimination of that had been a slogan of the left. You know, that had been what it, one of the things that had been fought for, in order to denounce and to renounce and to eliminate subordination, class subordination. So I think it's an interesting aspect which Trotsky brings there, brings the whole document to life. I think, thank you for what you have presented, Ian. I think it's a capitally important chapter. I would go back to the way, besides socialism in one country, which had been, of course, the mentality which had demolished Lenin's vision of the Communist Party. There was now the theory that the Central Committee is everything and the party is nothing. You know, I'm just quoting this little bit from one of the pages. And so what Ian has shown is the mechanism which led to the expulsion, really, of the working class from the Bolshevik Party. It took a long time and it was done incrementally. It was done through administration. I think there was also there were very objective conditions, because when there were Soviets and everybody could have their say, the Soviets then could influence and could have representatives at the level of the party and of administration. But then, apart from the perfidiousness and degeneration that took place in the leadership, there were also, and fundamentally, I think most importantly, a retreat which was forced by the class struggle on a world scale. I don't know how many countries invaded the young Soviet Union in 1918, and then I think something like 30 countries were involved in sending weapons and trying to put the Bolsheviks down. And so these things, in the end, they have a cost. We cannot take over a factory if that factory is not occupied, if that the occupation in a factory doesn't reproduces in other factories, then that initial one will fail. And the interesting thing is that here the retreat was tremendous, but the revolution in the end was never returned. The counter-revolution didn't go back like we saw last time. I think another aspect, so the Civil War was one. So in the Civil War, you have to defend yourself militarily. You cannot suddenly have a mass meeting in order to take a decision about this and that in the locality, because people have got to fight. And so on the one hand, there was a retreat, which came from a retreat of the will and of the determination to keep to this, to keep to the struggle. And then that was feeding back upon itself in a situation when objectively you could not really have proper discussions, party discussions, Soviet discussions, factory discussions. All this was retreating. Then there was this, and then there were many other factors, like the loss of the Bolshevik leaders in the Civil War, and then the having to construct, to build the worker state, which had to be done by the Bolshevik Party as well. So once they had lost masses of people, they had also had to send them to the administration of the new state. And so the party was exhausted, it was short of leaders, and it was obliged to retake people from the old regime, because these ones had experience. If you build a state, you cannot do it with somebody who doesn't know anything at all about administration, for example, or council administration. And so the talent of previous, which existed in previous bureaucracies, had to be reincorporated. With Lenin was making sure that the party would incorporate these things on the basis of the communist perspective. But now that Lenin died and the party was degenerating, then all sorts of people came in, and I think it was mentioned in the document, the leadership of Stalin allowed all sorts of party people to come in the party on any basis, so you didn't have to know anything about Marxism. And even though it's not incorrect to incorporate people who do not know, they were not being educated. On the contrary, they were weighing with all the backward conceptions of the previous regime. They were weighing on the party and making even the degeneration even worse. Just to try to summarize, I think the document was giving three centers of the degeneration of the Bolshevik party. It started, like Rakovsky had said. Rakovsky had put that, I'm looking at the quote. Rakovsky had said, in a proletarian state where capitalist accumulation is forbidden to the members of the ruling party, the differentiation, so here I'm going to say the degeneration, is at first functional, but afterwards becomes social. And then Rakovsky say, I do not say that this new setup becomes a class differentiation, but it's a social one. I think this is important to notice that it started with administratively, the working class no longer had a way to express itself, and then it became expressed socially, when in fact you had to show respect. And then this led to a cultural retreat, which is passing in the language, like was expressed in what Ian and Susan mentioned, of showing deference, which becomes a normal. It becomes normal because you don't notice it anymore, because now you say sir to the bloke who is in the Central Committee, and the bloke in the Central Committee says to or te to you, which is a way of showing that you are the one at the back, which is now culturally the incrustation of the degeneration in a very small highlight, but nevertheless very very evocative. So I think we should continue to study this degeneration and keeping courage that that all this abominable process did not stop the actual revolutions, other revolutions developing in the world, like the Chinese one, which would be started in 27, and then there was another one in 49. So the humanity was not made to retreat. Just that it was a much longer process now, which would take decades in advancing. Yeah. Finished.
Okay, Clive wants to speak. Yeah. You're muted, Clive. Yeah.
I am unmuted.
Okay.
Right. Has that worked?
Yes.
Right. Well, thanks, Ian, very much for the presentation. It was very clear and splendid. And one thing I enjoyed very much about reading the text for today's talk and discussion is the quality of the writing. It's so sort of stylish and clear and elegant, almost like French elegance or elegance. And there's all sorts of reasons why that may well be the case. I suspect that Trotsky spoke very fluent French and probably wrote a bit as well. And hence all the cultural references to T and V and the way people addressed each other between the classes. And also, it may well be the reasoning behind the references that Trotsky makes to the French Revolution. And Thermidor is, of course, part of the French Revolution, the renaming of the months of the calendar. Anyway, that's just a commentary, really, and thank you. And the one thing I did wonder, it's more of a question, really, is what was the difference between Trotsky's notion of democratic centralism and Stalin's? Because my understanding of that one of those forms of democratic centralism is such that there are temporary factions which are, once something has been decided on, then it's been decided on, and the centralism is in saying we will now apply that agreed procedure. Of course, the other version of that is having permanent factions all the time. For example, the IMG used to operate that way. You may well recall the permanent factions. I think at one time had four different factions on the same subject, which was trying to whether they should include the SWP or try and amalgamate. I don't think that ever happened. I don't know what happened to the IMG. But there you go. I asked that as a question, really.
Sure.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to speak on this at the moment? Also, I'll come in on that if somebody else wants to speak. Well, just briefly, I mean, I think the differences were not philosophical between Lenin and Stalin. They were practical. They became hardened into a different ethos through the practical sort of application of the bureaucracy's interests, It wasn't originally a doctrinal dispute. It was one about how the regime would operate, in practice. And actually, the strategic differences were about socialism in one country versus the world revolution. It was a break with the whole ethos of Bolshevism. To actually have this nationalist program of socialism in one country. Whereas, in fact, the material reality was that the progressive social relations in the October that were embodied in the October Revolution could only be developed on an international scale in a consistent way. So really what Stalin was doing was what the bureaucracy was beginning to do was to rule out of order the internationalist positions of the Bolshevik Party, the internationalist traditions, and gradually whittle it away. So more and more restrictions on, yes, I mean, obviously the Bolsheviks had to deal with problems of the counter-revolution intervening in Russia, as Marie said. It was there were dozen, there's at least a dozen, maybe more actual armies invaded Russia, and a lot more countries involved in supporting them. They had to deal with that, but the different question was the strategic goal of the revolution. For Stalin, it increasingly became one of national isolation and surviving in isolation somehow. Whereas for the Bolshevik Leninists, for the left opposition, it was about how to actually defend the revolution within the context of trying to extend it, which of course was the original goal of the Bolsheviks anyway. That was the strategic difference. So yeah, the left began to be suppressed. At times, the right was suppressed as well. When the right became too dangerous to Stalin, he suppressed the right wing, the Bukharinites, etc. He suppressed the people who were for the kulaks, who sided with the kulaks against against his regime. But in the end, it was about restricting the freedom of criticism, particularly of the left wing. And suppressing it, and that's actually what happened, of course, although we're reading ahead a little bit more in going into that. But that it wasn't an abstract philosophical difference. It's about practice. It's about suppressing the left wing versus fighting for the world revolution. And that's if you're suppressing your left wing, you don't need democracy to do that. You need something other than democracy, other than workers' democracy. And that's what evolved. They're pragmatically, completely pragmatically, they evolved me methods of suppressing the left wing, and that's how these differences came into existence, in my opinion. Now, what was the other point? I'll leave that there, and if you want to ask anything, you want to say anything more, I'll come back in a minute, if anybody else wants to come in on this. Yeah, Marie, you wanted to say something, or Paul? Paul, he hasn't spoken yet, and then I'll bring in Marie. Yeah.
Take Marie first. I only wanted to ask a question. Take Marie first, and
Okay.
then I'll come in.
Okay, Marie then. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I would like to come back to the democratic centralism idea. When I was becoming to be involved in the struggle, people would say to me that this was the beginning of what we have now, or what we had then, which was a sort of totalitarian situation due to the centralism particularly. And it seems to me that it's important to come back to say that that centralism was not the one of that as we would conceive in capitalism, of everybody having to be in the center and nobody being able to say anything different. This is not the centralization of the Bolshevik Party. It was, in fact, like Ian mentioned, a constant and ongoing struggle of tendencies. The Bolshevik Party, right from the beginning, was always a confrontation of ideas, and there had never been anything else with under Lenin. But that centralization, which was created on the basis of a choice that, of course, people would enter the party according to the fact that they actually wanted to make to create a new society, and there's nothing totalitarian about this. And once they were there, then they had the right to give their views and to influence and to determine the orientation of the party. And this was all the way through was the Bolshevik Party's way of functioning. It was democratic because all the tendencies could speak. They were all allowed, and it's only very, very late that they had to stop it, when in fact it was not allowing them to cope in front of the attack of imperialism. As Ian said, it was supposed to be momentary, temporary, but in fact, the situation worsened. And just another point, which I will try to make quickly now so that Paul can speak. There was a sort of a rolling process upon itself. Right at the beginning of this document, it says, "The Bolshevik Party prepared and ensured the October victory. It created the Soviet state and supplied it with a sturdy skeleton." This is very important. "And then the degeneration of the party became both cause and consequence of the bureaucratization." So here is where one finds dialectics. You cannot say this cause has led to the consequence, but there has been a combination of factors which in part were fed by the steps back being taken, which were now reinforcing the bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy bringing new step backwards, which I think is very interesting to study in the trade unions, for example. That's it.
Okay, Paul, then, yeah.
I will say something in the end. Going on from what Marie was saying, this whole thing about factoring, I think there's been a misinterpretation by some existing socialist groups of today that seem to suggest that you couldn't have factoring. But if you read what sort of unfolded in this chapter, part of me kind of think, well, you need sort of faction really for potential for constant renewal and to keep the bureaucracy in check. So if those democratic forces are still in place, part of me think, well, we shouldn't really fear factions. Obviously, if you get a massive bourgeoisie sort of faction, then I can understand why, there would be some concern. The other thing is, in the past, before we actually started reading this, sorry, Ian, do you want to come in on that point?
You carry on, you carry on.
The other thing is, when in the past, before we started reading Revolution Betrayed, people have often justified Stalin's actions by what was going on internationally, i.e., the number of countries invaded Russia and so on. Second World War, First and Second World War, come to it. But of course, we learn now that it's a big factor. I'm not taking that away, but it is only one factor. And of course, Trotsky is, of course, detailing that actually there were problems within the party that was also causing that degeneration. It wasn't just about the international factors. As big as it was, that was only one factor, and I just wanted to make that point. Well, that's the way I understand it anyway. And my question was, who was the IMG that Clive mentioned?
I will come back on that if you don't mind, because I actually didn't, I couldn't remember what Clive's second point was for a little while I was making my first one. But anyway, who were the IMG? The IMG were the International Marxist Group. They were the British section of the United Secretariat of the Fourth International in the 70s mainly, and also the early 80s. They still exist in a different under a different name. They're now called Anti-Capitalist Resistance, and they are politically awful. Really, really bad. They support Zelensky. They supported the overthrow of Gaddafi. All sorts of terrible positions. They really are awful. But actually, going back to the old days of the IMG, the IMG was seen as very left wing in the 70s. They were the people who cheered for the Vietnamese and were the most militant supporters of the Viet Cong and whatever. They were the most left-wing sections of what was the United Secretariat of the Fourth International, which was the main current of Trotskyism, except that it wasn't really Trotskyist after about 1953, because it had basically liquidated its politics into cheering for various Stalinist factions and movements. And it sort of morphed much later into support for counter-revolution in the name of democracy, actually. That was in the 80s, But in the 60s and seventies, they were very radical Stalinist type cheerleaders, But I mean, they had factions all the time. It is true, And I think we're not afraid of factional rights. We're actually very much in favor of it. But an organization that has permanent factions that never dissolve has a political problem because they don't actually have the coherence to actually maintain a single unitary position. And the reason that they've got all these different factions is because they're different opportunist elements and they're tailing after different forces. I think that was the problem. Mark Hayes arrived. Brilliant. This is. He obviously didn't get the message about the change of time, which is unfortunate. But anyway, the point is that the IMG, it's fine that they had factional rights. It's very much in favour of it. But the fact they had six factions by most of the time was an indication that they had no coherence and they didn't agree with each other on fundamentals and they would fight like cat and dog about all sorts of things. And really, it posed the question: Are these people coherent enough to stay in the same organisation as each other over a long period? And the answer is no, they weren't. And they splintered off in lots of directions afterwards, much later. And all of these factions became small groups, and most of them anyway, and tore the hell out of each other, and then dissolved into various different milieu. And the result, you've got a miserable little excuse for an organisation that's left over, in my opinion. You know, the IMG was quite a sizable organisation in the 70s. Had a lot of and a lot of attractive power, and it was the British section of the Fourth International, as seen by many, by most actually. But now it's just, who knows who they are? Very few people, unfortunately, because they're obscure. They've buried themselves in various things in the Labour Party, deep entrism for long periods. They've buried themselves in other sorts of politics, green politics. You know, all sorts of different things, feminist politics, stuff that's really not Marxist. And that was the problem. They had no coherence. So that's where all the many factions came. The SWP had the alternative problem, which is they could not deal with political differences, so they banned factions for most of the time. You know, that's the inverse of the problem of the IMG. The IMG had so many factions because they didn't agree with each other on fundamentals. The SWP, it tries to enforce agreement with its fundamentals by banning factions most of the time. You're only allowed to form a faction for a month and a half before 6 weeks before conference or something like that. You know, and it's banned apart from that, you know. So that's just two different ways of dealing with a problem, that they don't really have the coherence to lead a proper democratic centralist regime, you know, because they've got political problems get in the way. If you don't have a revolutionary program, if you don't have enough coherence to do that, you'll either end up as a shambolic mess of gaggle of lots of different factions, or you use bureaucratic methods to keep people united, you know. And that's two different ways of solving, of dealing with the same problem, really, which is the bad politics, in my opinion. If that's of any help.
Yeah.
Very much welcome to Mark. I'm sorry if there's a mix up about the time, but I had to bring this earlier by an hour because there's a Palestine event on a bit later on.
Yeah, no, it's the old head off influence again. It was a short term memory. I did get your message in time at the Tuesday's meeting.
Okay, fair enough.
I remember that at least.
That's all right, mate.
So, can I just say one thing? So, Ian, well, the thing you were saying then is that the coherence came from the revolutionary program, about which one could have several tactics, of course.
Yeah.
So this is why at Brest-Litovsk, it was a defeat in many ways. They had to yield ground to Germany. So that was a defeat. But it wasn't taken as a defeat by the masses of the masses continued to support the revolution, and the Bolshevik Party did not decompose. There was a lot of problem, but that was something which was extremely difficult to do, and they did. They managed it.
Yeah. Paul.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is interesting, worth remembering, particularly for those that are going through it at the time when they face defeat. Also, I've had private conversations with Marie about this. Marie was explaining to me that once a defeat has happened, Kropsky was talking about it never goes back to the way it was. There are still remnants of the forces that are still there, that then, if that makes sense. And one of the examples I can think of that in the UK is probably the Toll Paddle Marches.
What is that?
I think it's Mark Coates' sake.
Me switching the light off. Sorry.
I think I don't want.
Hang on, Mark. Can you mute your mic?
Yeah.
I think that's what's wrong. There's something's jamming everything. Carry on, Paul.
I think one example is the Tolpuddle Martyrs. They had a terrible defeat at the time, and of course they were all arrested, and they were sentenced to Cramportation, and that was just simply for setting up a union and throwing an oath to being part of the co-union. But in the long run, it led to the birth of the co-union movement. Yes, although the people of Western were arrested, crampled, and locked up, the cause never actually disappeared. And so I think that's a very good example of suffering a catastrophic defeat, and yet somehow, years later, that then becomes part of our fabric, and the ideas are then carried on by other generations of people that then put that in those into keeping in place. Thanks.
Cheers. Anybody else want to speak on this? Oh, that's interesting. Marie wants to speak, yeah?
Sorry, I don't want to take the space of other people. Nobody else?
Nobody else. Carry on.
Oh, okay. I just noticed another aspect of, when you were talking, Ian, the key is the revolutionary program, because then that creates the cohesion. I think that it was very interesting that I would put the origin of one of the origins of the degeneration in this question of defending socialism in one country, so that you can still speak in terms of socialism, but in your country, which is an impossibility, of course, which is going to fail, obviously, because it's not possible. But it was not an administrative measure. It was not a bureaucratic one, not obviously a bureaucratic one. It was not a cultural retreat. It was programmatic. Mm-hmm. And so this is where Ian was saying is so important, that a retreat from a programmatic retreat from the actual organization to change society can generate all this cascade of degeneration and, in fact, disgusting marrying, ending up a proletarian, ending up marrying the girls of the aristocracy, which is what happened, you know? And Babeuf had mentioned this. Babeuf, who had been in the French Revolution, when he came out of prison, he noticed that the Jacobins, who had now they had abandoned much of their those who survived, had given up or collaborated, and they were now married with girls who had been clever girls who clever enough to they had had the means to make themselves attractive. And they were bringing back to the revolution all the notions and all the degenerate ideas of the aristocracy. And so that was interesting, this aspect of the revolution was made to retreat. And in that process, it looked backwards. A lot of it looked backwards and went backward. And then the class that had been defeated had still its means to penetrate the revolutionary leadership. And this is very important to remember that all this is extremely dynamic, and there is nothing static. Nothing solid in the process of history, everything is in flux, and every class has an influence on the other class. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Anybody else on this topic, on the educational? If there's nobody, Diana. Okay, carry on.
Yeah, one point I noticed was the reference to subservience to authority. So that it's kind of a bit related to what Marie is saying, only at the other end of the class scale, that there are people who were who were incorporated into the Bolshevik Party, among the mass of people were people who'd been used to the authoritarian state under the Tsar, so they carried on accepting the authoritarianism.
That's true, yes. I mean, I think that was what the Lenin levy was about. You know, it's about bringing people into the party who are not politically conscious and diluting the membership thereby. Because I mean, yes, you bring in workers who are not political necessarily to dilute the influence of the highly political workers who were already in the party who joined when it was more difficult to join, you know, because it was difficult because it involved privations and problems and fighting against the ruling class. Whereas now you bring in people who were never really involved in any of the fights against the ruling class and have a lower level of consciousness and dilute it. And that provides voting fodder for the bureaucracy. You know, that's what the Lenin levy was about. I think that is the opposite. I mean, just on the question of factions, is that just repeat what Trotsky said about the Bolshevik leadership and how it dealt with the question of factions. He said the far-sightedness of the Bolshevik leadership often made it possible to soften conflicts and shorten the duration of factional struggle, but no more than that. That's what he was talking. That's what because they had a coherent program, they could do that. They had the foresight to be able to. People obviously will come up with different facets of the possibilities of what needs to be done in any given situation, and that will lead to disagreements and possible factional groupings forming if that becomes a slightly more drawn out process. But that doesn't mean that. But that freedom doesn't mean that permanent factions should crystallize and become permanent war with each other. That's what happened in the United Secretariat, not just in Britain, actually. It happened everywhere because they had no coherent program. And therefore, they were always at war with each other about something, you know. But you don't need to suppress that with bureaucratic means. And that was what went on in Russia. They suppressed it with bureaucratic means over time because what they were dealing with was they didn't need a revolutionary program. It became more and more. For the core of the regime, the regime that began to emerge, it became an irksome nuisance to have to debate the ideas of people who are actually on a revolutionary program. This is a menace. This is getting in the way of building socialism in one country. You know, so naturally, you started to see this thing. Well, this is illegal to cause all these problems and all this. That's how it's the psychology of it. You're causing us problems. We don't want you. And eventually they chucked out the left wing. You know, that's the way these things work, unfortunately, if you don't have a revolutionary program in many cases. because they had a program that was basically, you know, basically for the status quo or some sort of status collaboration with the world status quo, even though it was a complete illusion because the imperialists would never leave them alone. And that was subsequently shown over the whole decades. And that led to the destruction of the Soviet Union eventually. They would never leave them alone. Hitler never left them alone. The US after the Second World War never left them alone. And eventually, the US turned the screw and they broke the Soviet economy by its greater productive power. And the Soviet economy, effectively collapsed and had to be reconstituted on a different basis, which is now bourgeois, but in a funny way. But that's a different question altogether. But yeah, it's about this, that if you've got a nationalist program of socialism in one country, you don't need democratic centralism. You need people to shut up the troublemaking left wing, and that's the way, that's why it really happened, Anybody else want to say anything on this? If not, should we stop the recording, and we can then.